When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by Michael Cunningham. He's a visiting fellow in the Asian Studies Center over at the Heritage Foundation and the author of a really interesting and important new report out from Heritage. You can read it on heritage.org. It's called Why State Legislatures Must Confront Chinese Infiltration. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, and I think it's your first time on the podcast, so if you could start just by walking us a little bit through your career, you know, how did you end up as a visiting fellow over at Heritage focusing on these issues?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So up until about a year ago, I was actually in China. So I was working as a political risk analyst. It's a sort of less known area of business consulting. So informing businesses about how the political situation in China affects their profits and their operations. And so I was doing that, but always sort of felt like I could be doing more. I mean, it's really important to work for businesses to help them be able to provide for their employees, of course. But I was never driven so much by profits so much as I was, you know, wanting to use the expertise I've developed to make a bigger difference on policy. And so I decided about a year ago, it culminated in me coming back about a year ago. I decided quite a while ago that I wanted to get into the think tank community. And I was very fortunate to come across the Heritage Foundation. I've been a longtime fan of the Heritage Foundation's work after having to work for woke private businesses for the majority of my career. It really has been a breath of fresh air. And the team over there is very much, you know, where I don't see people in it for their egos. It's very much we're working to try to make a difference and have an impact on policy for the better.
So I'm assuming you actually speak and read Mandarin. One of the few people, I think, in this space on the right, which is where so many of these important inquiries are being, you know, actually pursued as opposed to other areas, there's just not a lot of people with a background like yours. So that's incredibly valuable. And Heritage is very lucky to have you, Michael.
Well, thank you. I feel very lucky to be with such brilliant people.
So let's dive into this report. Again, the title is Why State Legislatures Must Confront Chinese Infiltration. And I'm sure some members of the listening audience have heard, like I have, basically rumblings here and there of how the Chinese government has sought to infiltrate or influence leaders at the state and local level. It's really undercovered by the media, partially because I think it's hard to dive into and fully understand. So if, Michael, you could just give us some background on what's going on. You know, what actually is the Communist Party doing in the United States when it comes to getting the ear and gaining the favor of people on the state and local level?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the better question is, what are they not doing? Because they are very, very active. And I think, you know, there's a lot more attention to sort of what they're doing at the national level because it makes more sense, right? And I think this is where a lot of state officials are sort of, you know, caught by surprise because this has been going on for years, for decades. But, you know, it makes a lot of sense to everyone conceptually that, yeah, China wants to infiltrate the CIA, the U.S. Congress, but, you know, why would they care about, say, the mayor's office of a small town in the Midwest that most people have never heard of? But they are, you know, very, very active. And I think really there are two reasons that they do this. One is that some state officials, well, some local officials are going to become state officials, and some state officials are going to become federal officials. And so, you know, that the earlier they can get sort of embedded in these people's careers, in their offices, in their circles, the better for them, you know, especially because they're doing it at a time when a lot of these political figures are not expecting it, and nobody's expecting it really. So their guard is down. And then the other reason really is, you know, they want to affect, China wants to affect policies at the state and local levels, and through them, then the national level. So for example, a state, you know, different states have different interests, and some are, say, agricultural exporters. And if a particular state is reliant on exports to China, then China has quite a bit of leverage over that state. And they know it, and they use this leverage. There was a lot of talk, you know, back, you know, this is getting sort of onto the national level, but it's so closely related to state politics, is back, particularly in the last presidential election. There is a lot of talk about whether China was going to try to disrupt some key Republican states and some key battleground states. We're talking places like Iowa in the Midwest by disrupting agricultural exports, by just not buying. And so that's a constant sort of, I guess, reminder of how China can and sometimes does use its leverage it has over states. But, you know, you ask, you know, how do they do this? That's one area, but another area is just, you know, I think a good example is there's a congressman from California that when he was just a city councilor in a small city, he was being groomed and manipulated by a Chinese agent. We don't know the nature of that relationship, but it later came out that Chinese agent had also slept with various mayors of Midwestern towns. And so, you know, that the FBI informed him, and he has reportedly cut off all communication with that individual. But this is very, very common. It's like, what interest would the Chinese state have in, say, these mayors in these small Midwestern towns? Well, they definitely do have interests. And it just shows how granular these efforts are.
It's amazing in the report how granular the efforts are, and I want to get into some of the big examples that you point out. But before we get into that, a lot of people, if they're like me, are probably thinking, this sounds like Belt and Road, and it sounds like the United States at the local level is sort of inviting this granular kind of Belt and Road that's off the radar of the federal government, off the radar of the media. How does this compare with what China has done in other countries, in Africa, and other Asian countries when it comes to Belt and Road?
Well, when it comes to Belt and Road, so Belt and Road for any listeners who aren't familiar with that is an infrastructure program that China has, where it's going throughout mostly the developing world, and it's developing infrastructure, which, you know, in many of these countries, no one else was willing to really invest, because frankly, they're often bad investments and under dangerous circumstances. And so we see that China, I mean, it is, you know, very much related, because it's partially an influence operation to sort of spread Chinese influence by being the country that is creating this infrastructure for these countries. But then there are also security risks for the countries that accept it. And so we see in the US also, and I think what you're getting at is the infrastructure part. So one of the four, right. the report goes into four distinct areas where China has considerable leverage, and it knows it and is sort of taking advantage of let's say lax legal frameworks. And so one of these areas is quite similar actually to what happens in the Belt and Road. And I would point out that as far as China is concerned, the whole world is part of the Belt and Road. So an investment by a Chinese company in the US could be very, very well reported in China as a Belt and Road investment, even though the US does not support the Belt and Road Initiative. But what we see happening is Chinese companies, they either propose, so they just say, hey, I'm going to build a wind farm and help you guys out, contribute to your energy grid. Or they bid for contracts to build infrastructure or to supply technology, say for to a state government, and what we have there then is two problems really. One is sort of what we're seeing along the Belt and Road is that Chinese firms are able to win a lot of infrastructure projects because they underbid the competition by about 30%. These are companies that often state-owned enterprises that have a lot of subsidies from the Chinese government. And so they're able to do that. And the risk there is, and they're seeing this in Europe already, is that companies are being essentially squeezed out of their home market by Chinese competitors that are just able to go in at a much lower price. And so that's not good when your future infrastructure needs are going to have to be serviced by the Chinese or by someone else, because there's no longer, hypothetically, we don't yet have that situation in the US, but hypothetically, there's no longer the US firms that can service it. But the even bigger crisis, and this is one that we see happening right now, is that you're essentially, there's someone who's constantly talking about robbing you, has a history of armed robbery, or at least breaking and entering, and then you hire them to install locks on your doors. Right. That's essentially...
It's like Huawei.
Yeah, exactly. That's essentially right. What we do when we let Chinese firms with links to the Communist Party, when we use their infrastructure or their technology in state offices, we're essentially inviting them in and saying, hey, come check out, take a look at what we're doing. And when they're creating, when they're building infrastructure, they also often, there are technical elements to that, but also they can embed, flaws or other weaknesses that can then be used in times of conflict. So,
yeah, I wanted to ask you about an example you use from Texas in this report that was really interesting to me. This is July of 2021, the Lone Star Infrastructure Protection Act. You write, the bill was developed after a Chinese billionaire with ties to the CCP and People's Liberation Army and a business empire in Xinjiang attempted to build a wind farm on land that he purchased near a U.S. Air Force base. Can you tell us more about this case study?
Yeah, this is really a frightening case study. What happened essentially was, that the man came in, the billionaire, he comes in and he buys all this land and he decides he's going to create it into a wind farm. And initially the locals, they complained about this to the government because, it was initially for environmental reasons. They felt it was going to be damaging for the environment in that area. I believe there's a big river that is considered sort of a wildlife or some kind of a reserve over there. And they were worried about that. And that didn't get anywhere. But the more they looked at this issue, they realized, oh my goodness, this is really close to an Air Force base. Not to mention the question of, you know, they're creating a wind farm that's going to be part of the electrical grid. That also potentially gives China quite a bit of leverage. Now it's possible that this guy just saw this as a good investment, but his background reasonably leads anyone that and the physical location close to an Air Force base, you know, would reasonably lead anyone to question the motives and to conclude that, you know, regardless of the motives, a Chinese businessman, the Chinese Communist Party has leverage over his business empire. Probably not a good idea to have him investing in this kind of infrastructure, particularly in that kind of location. But interestingly, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS, had approved the deal. So it was going forward, and it would have if Texas hadn't, in true Texas fashion, stepped in and said, not on my watch. But I would point out another sort of concern that even this case study, and this is a successful case study of a state jumping in and not making this investment possible. But even here, we see how it was reactive. There was nothing on the books to prevent this from happening until they were faced with this immediate crisis. And then, to their credit, the state legislature came through and very quickly put this bill together, passed it. I believe it was unanimous. Good on them, I have to say.
Yeah, and this you also talk about the education sector. And you write basically that when China provides funding, they expect something in return. And it, you know, that is a very, very, very important framework in which to think about everything you just talked about when it comes to infrastructure. But can you talk about education? I know people are pretty familiar with Confucius Institutes. They're pretty familiar with the way that's been a concerted effort on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party to gain leverage over academia and American institutions and to, you know, spread propaganda. There are deeper concerns than just propaganda. The leverage, when you get at this question of funding, is a really important one. What can you tell us about that when it comes to academia and higher education in America?
Yeah, so this is, you know, I would say, well, as all of these issues are, it's a priority of the Communist Party in Beijing. You know, it through sort of the money that it's able to dangle over universities' heads, it's able very much, and studies have shown that it does impact the curricula, the research. I you know, as someone who you know, although it was quite some time ago, was a product of sort of the U.S. educational system. I studied China as an undergraduate and graduate. And, you know, looking back now and knowing what I know now about China, I can see how a lot of the curricula at U.S. universities, the textbooks that are used, the version of history that's taught, a lot of it very much is sort of in line with the Beijing's preferred narrative. Now, to universities' credits, and I don't want to take this too far and say that, you know, that we gloss over the rest of, you know, the ugliest parts of China's history. At least that's still taught in U.S. universities. But a lot of Beijing's preferred narratives seem to seep in. And, you know, not to mention sort of the, there's sort of a reluctance to push back at China. So I use in the report, I use a couple examples. One being, and I think this is really important, being sort of the degradation of freedom of speech on U.S. campuses, where you see, for example, a Uyghur student at Cornell University asks a question during a university forum. And as part of her question, mentions that she has a brother that's in a concentration camp, essentially, in Xinjiang. And immediately, you know, dozens of Chinese students start jeering her. They make a public show of walking out of the forum because someone had the gall to mention the human rights abuses in Xinjiang. And we see that all the time. I have former professors of mine and other professors that I know in the DC area and elsewhere that tell me that, you know, they're just finding it's becoming increasingly difficult to talk about China, to teach about China, because of the behavior of a small minority, but a very vocal minority of the students from China, and that universities don't really have a way of resolving that. Actions that sometimes amount to hate crimes against other Asian students, Taiwanese, Hong Kong students, South Korean students, by a minority of very vocal, very in-your-face type of Chinese students.
Just
one example of sort of the how we see China's influence over universities having an impact. And I would say the other example is the one I use in the report, also far too common, where a Chinese student was detained in China. She was detained just for using a virtual private network to get over China's great firewall and access her homework so that she could do her work. She spent 2 years between re-education and house arrest, and her university did nothing, did not speak out about it, gave her no meaningful support. And the State Department at the time alleged that it was because there was a big deal with China that the university was waiting for.
Fluffy bread, fresh tortillas, classic burger buns, and so many carbs. Carb fear is real, but Hero Bread makes healthier versions of the carb-heavy favorites we love most. We're talking fewer calories, 0 to 2 grams net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and seriously, great taste. Made from a new recipe using heart-healthy olive oil and resistant wheat starch that acts as a prebiotic fiber to promote gut health, Hero Bread products have more of the dietary fiber and protein you want without the net carbs and sugar you don't. There's something for every craving. Sliced bread loaves, buns, and tortillas, plus monthly small batch drops of indulgent favorites with no compromise. Like the 2 gram net carb Hero croissant or the 1 gram net carb Hero cheddar biscuit. Don't skip out on your favorites. Just use Hero Bread. Get 10% off your order at hero.co with code HEROPOD at checkout. That's HEROPOD at HERO.co.
So if we start with education and then we'll move to infrastructure, what can be done? What can policymakers, I assume probably the best space for legislative action is indeed on the local level, on the state level. That's not to say there aren't any federal solutions. I'm curious as to, there's some of this in the report, but I'm curious as to what you would say in terms of the breakdown of what can be done on each level. But what are some of the policy solutions going forward?
Yeah. So first of all, the way policy sort of traditionally has been is I think it's centered on two things, one being reporting and the other being what I would call negative lists. And so a negative list for listeners who might not be familiar with the concept is you put down a list of, say, companies that or industries or something. Let's say companies that are bad, you cannot invest in. And then the message is that everything else is fine because everything not on this list is okay. There's no legal impediment to going and doing business or investing in that company, or say a university accepting a grant from that company or that organization. And so what I would say is, one of the most important things, and that those two approaches are very common at the federal level, because there's just so much, there's a massive number of competing interests and everything. The federal legislation often has to balance, and lots of times it does result, to the chagrin of many in Congress, it does result in sort of less effective legislation. And so for state legislatures, what I would say is probably one of the most important things they can do is get away from these sort of approaches that are just all, you just have to report to us, just report how much money you're getting from foreign adversaries, and stay also away from these approaches of, you know, every company except those on this list. Do not allow any companies on this list to build infrastructure in your in the state. Both of those approaches are less effective because they don't really do anything. Reporting is just reporting. It doesn't stop anyone from doing business. It would be good if the reporting is actually enforced, that it would, you know, to an extent, it would create more visibility, transparency. But
kind of like FARA.
Yeah, like FARA, exactly. And right. which by the way, isn't really complied with. There are some figures in the report, something like 1.6 billion or something. FARA, yes, that's on the the lobbying side. I was actually thinking, as you mentioned that, I was talking about the Section 117 of the higher education law. Also, is another one where, you know, something like 1.6 billion in foreign contributions were reported the last 6 months of Trump's presidency, and that went down to something like 5 million the first year of Biden's presidency, which is showing how to the extent to which it's not being enforced. And I would say FARA is essentially the same thing. It's not enforced most of the time.
I want to ask also about your experience in China. The country has changed a lot in recent years. What do you think people in America should understand about China, and maybe what they don't understand about China?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And there are a million ways to take that. But I would say, I would say Americans often, they don't understand how much like us the Chinese are. And what I mean by that is, you know, I think a lot of the misunderstandings between citizens come from the language barrier. And I think there is a tendency to view China as a civilization, and even the Chinese government as sort of mysterious and, you know, mysterious beyond understanding. And so I would say that, but contradictorily, I would also say that Americans also don't understand how different China is from us in some pretty significant and pretty fundamental ways. One of which being, you know, there's this tendency when analysts look at China to say, well, they wouldn't do such and such because of the impact it would have on the economy. And, you know, from our perspective, politics exists essentially to serve the economy, to make us better off, to make the people and the nation wealthy. In China, the economy is very important, but it's a political tool. Politics reigns above all else. And so where the economy and politics come into conflict is always political interests that are going to trump economic interests. And so often, you know, you hear pundits saying, oh, China wouldn't such and such. Well, often, yes, it would.
Yeah. And you know, the perspective from actually having lived there, I think, is helpful, because when you're in the United, like, part of the problem here is that access has sort of increasingly been cut off, that we are less and less familiar with everyday life. And it, not just, of course, not just on our end, on their end, the internet is controlled so tightly that it's difficult for both of us to understand each other going forward. So that's actually really fascinating. Is there any, is there anything when it comes to Huawei in particular? I know I mentioned that the example is like they had been undercutting competitors with suspiciously low prices and implementing their equipment, basically getting locals to implement their equipment on near military bases, seemingly strategically near military bases. And, you know, they say there's no way that they, the government would have any access to that. Some of this is public live streaming and, you know, whatever. But what is the, when you're in, let's say, Beijing or Shanghai, what does the surveillance state kind of look like there? What is it? You know, obviously it's different in like Xinjiang than it is elsewhere, but what does it look like when you're walking the streets there now?
Yeah. Hopefully listeners couldn't hear me laughing hysterically when you said that Huawei says that there's no way that the government can access the data. Because frankly, in China, we take it for granted that the Chinese government can and does access whatever it feels like. Now, to be fair, it's not going to access everyone's data, because we're talking a country with 1.4 billion people plus, you know, whatever non-Chinese individuals and entities it's dealing with. But Chinese companies, tech companies, routinely put backdoors in their technology. They have access to the data and the systems of those who use their products and their software as well. And the government basically, you know, according to Chinese law, they have to turn over that data to the government if the government asks for it. So to your question, you know, what does it look like in Beijing or Shanghai or anywhere in China? What does the surveillance state look like? I have been stopped by police on the street for standard passport checks. Foreigners are required to constantly carry their passport. Chinese are required to have their Chinese government issued ID with them at all times. And, you know, I haven't had the passport with me because they were in the process of renewing my visa. So the police officer takes out a handheld device that looks like a phone, scans my face, and points at two files that come up with my picture on them and says, "Is this you?" So that's sort of how intense it's gotten. There are CCTV cameras everywhere. And, you know, to one extent, I mean, you know, it's not all, you know, negative. I mean, the loss of freedom is something that should not be acceptable anywhere, but they do use it both for good and for bad. You know, kidnappings of children have gone way down because they're able to literally track the kidnappers and have police waiting for them at the train station when they get off the train on the other side of the country. But, you know, it doesn't make up for just the fear that people feel in China. They know the government's constantly watching them. I have just one more anecdote, not to belabor this issue to death, but I had a colleague who literally, you know, told her mother in Hong Kong, "Mom, I'm going to Hong Kong next weekend." And this was in the height of the Hong Kong protests. The police showed up the next day. She had just said this over a messaging app. The next day, the police showed up at the office where I was working at the time and interrogated her.
Wow. Oh, goodness. How long did you live in China?
So off and on for about 7 years in mainland China. I also spent some time in Taiwan, about 3.5 years there, which was very pleasant. It was a welcome change. But I was in China in 2006, and sort of, you know, that was, I guess, the height of freedom in China. Mm-hmm. Seemed like things were just becoming more and more free. And then I was there sort of after the Olympics and after the global financial crisis, and watched how the state was clamping down more and more. And this predates the current president, Xi Jinping, by the way. And then I was there 2017 through last year, and just it was incredible how fast the government is really clamping down on civil society and on freedoms there.
Okay, that's really fascinating insight, because it does seem as though the country has changed swiftly, but also that part of this is, you know, a strategy that's longer term and predates, as you said, even Xi Jinping. Can you speak to the sort of, this is something the report really gets at, though, what the long-term strategy of Xi Jinping is when it comes to foreign influence? What is this, how does this wrap into, I guess, his broader idea of China's place on the world stage?
Yeah. So he sees China, and this isn't just Xi. I mean, this is basically the Chinese Communist Party has long sort of viewed China as, you know, its rightful place being at the top of the world order. And it sees itself, sincerely sees itself as benevolent in that regard. But part of its benevolence is, you know, knowing who is, you know, as it would say, sort of on the wrong side, and who it needs to use coercive measures against, which we see is not the way it employs them now is not benevolent at all. But it very much, I think the strategy is very much focused, I think, on sort of the developing world quite a bit. So, and this is, you know, one aspect of its strategy. But it looks at the developing world sort of, you know, that's the majority of countries. The majority of countries are also, they're either not democratic or they're semi-democratic. And so I think at this point, you know, he's shifted some of the focus from appeasing the liberal democracies, the United States, Western Europe, towards, you know, approaching countries that may not have benefited as much from global economic growth and from the liberal world order, and saying, hey, you know, we're here to sort of reform the international system, and it appeals to a lot of governments, not as much to people in most countries, but it appeals to a lot of governments of these non-democratic countries. And so that's I think a big part of its of China's strategy that Xi is very much getting at as well. And China feels like it's more powerful than it was in the past. So whereas in the past, you know, the focus was, look, we need to keep as low of a profile as possible to minimize pushback and fear of our rise by the U.S. and other global powers. Now they feel like, okay, we've sort of arrived, not quite yet, but we're in a good position. We're going to be more assertive.
And on that point, just my last question is, because this is important, I think, to China's ability to sustain its rise, there was what appeared to be sort of a crack in the foundation. And, you know, it happens time to time, as would be understandable. But when lockdowns were reimposed, I think it was in Shanghai earlier this year, and videos were going viral of people really upset. I talked to somebody at the time, actually, I'm forgetting who it was, who was saying, you know, in a way, the CCP would see that as a win because it shows they're still capable of cracking down. and it shows they're still capable of sort of asserting their power, even when it's difficult, even when people are upset. But did you sense, as the country was changing really quickly, any shifts in broad public loyalty to the government? Any sort of how are the people of China? It's a huge question, but just from your sense of it, how are the people of China, I guess, reacting to some of these big changes that people in other countries would say look kind of fascist?
Yeah, yeah, and I appreciate that you used that that F word, because I it is quite appropriate for a lot of sort of the changes that China has made. Look, to the average people in China, I mean, the average person actually still views sort of the zero COVID policy as a success. They're not too worried by a lot of these measures that the government takes until it affects them. And then they get pretty upset. But often, you know, you mentioned the lockdowns. Usually when these lockdowns finally end, people are so happy to be free, to move around, to leave their apartment, that a lot of the anger that they had sort of dissipates immediately and often turns into glee. Look, we beat, you know, we kept infections at a minimum. We overcame again. It's yet to see whether that will play out in places like Shanghai, because they're still struggling with it. These newer variants are hard to keep under control, but you know, China is a diverse place, diverse thought. I know many people in China that have no love for Xi and no love for the CCP. And I know people who have a lot of love for the CCP and view Xi as being detrimental to the party. But the vast majority of people, you know, your peasants in the countryside, your taxi drivers, your workers, hundreds of millions of people, they, you know, their focus is on not getting in trouble, and they very much sort of see the central government, at least, as being on their side. When they have issues, they usually ascribe it to local authorities stepping out of bounds.
That's so interesting. Is there anything we haven't covered that you think people should know about, Michael?
That's a really good question. I mean, there's so much that people should know about China. I would just say, you know, sort of this discussion has focused on a lot of the risks that China poses, and those are very important. And I think, you know, our state governments really, and even when he was Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo called on state legislatures to take action related to China. You know, it has to be within the bounds of the Constitution, but they need to take action. It's very serious. At the same time, we have to remember that our adversary is the Chinese Communist Party. It's not the Chinese people. It's definitely not Chinese Americans, who are often the greatest victims of a lot of the action that Chinese agents take in the U.S. And so I think that's a really important point just to keep in mind, is none of what we've talked about should be used in any way to substantiate any feelings that anyone might have that are unfriendly towards the Chinese people, and especially towards our own citizens and residents of Chinese descent. The problem is the Chinese Communist Party, and we have to deal with them. They're unlikely to go away anytime soon. So it's really up to both federal and state legislatures, and even I'd say local legislatures, to take action within their jurisdictions to push back and fight back and protect the U.S. Constitution and protect our way of life as a nation.
Michael Cunningham, visiting fellow in the Asian Studies Center over at the Heritage Foundation, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can read the report at heritage.org. It's called Why State Legislatures Must Confront Chinese Infiltration. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more Federalist Radio Hour. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray. Darling, you got me right where you